This is a tutorial in the embryology that I've covered for you in both the lecture content and the practical content. It's not meant to be a lecture. So a tutorial is just that. If you've got specific questions or topics that you still have issues with or problems with, this is an opportunity to raise those and to get an answer from me in terms of what my expectations are. And secondly, it's an opportunity to also clarify some topics that we've been covering as we've gone along. So let me start by mentioning to you that BGDA is the first of two cycles that you'll be doing in BGD. This one is a way of, like foundations, giving you an overview of normal human development from conception and gametogenesis through to birth. Now, BGDB, on the other hand, will be covering in detail the development of systems. So we'll look at systems development in BGDB, and this includes the gut, the head and face, which we don't cover in great detail in BGDA, the sexual reproduction. Those sorts of topics are covered in detail in BGDB. But I would expect you to have a broad understanding about the timing of events as we go along. And this issue in timing is important to understand concepts of when things happen in human development and how this will eventually relate to your clinical practice. So an understanding about the sequence of events is important. Another issue that comes up in every one of my classes is that always the times and dates that are given seem to be extremely accurate. And what I can tell you is that they represent the average for a range of dates and times, and therefore there is a lot of variation in the absolute timing of these events. So whereby we say a certain event happens at a particular time, this is the average or the most typical thing. Just like saying the average menstrual cycle is 28 days in length, we know that there's a huge variation in terms of the overall cycle. So that's another issue to consider when we're talking about development. Probably more important than the absolute timing of events is to understand that they occur in sequence. So one thing has to happen before the next event can occur. So an understanding of the sequence of the events in development is probably more relevant to your understanding. The other issue that I'd like to raise is that in BGDA, I've only given two lectures on the timetable of development, but I have three practical classes that cover the same period. This means that in order to fit the content that I want to cover into the lectures, I have to be light for some of the content and shift it into the practical class. And I made just a technical decision to shift most of fetal development to be covered mainly within the practical class. But the content that I cover in the practical class should also be considered to be part of the theory, if you like, of normal human development. I just don't have a lecture on fetal development. Okay? So there's my preamble. I looked at, what's the online thing called? Where the discussion board is.
Blackboard.
Blackboard, yes, that I don't tend to use that much. And I couldn't see any specific questions that have been posted up there to be covered in today's tutorial. Now's the chance if you'd like to raise an issue that you'd like an answer to. Otherwise, I'll stand here for an hour and you can just absorb the knowledge as I stand here quietly. Is there anything from the lectures or the practical classes which seems to be not clear to you at this stage, or which you've had a variety of different responses or answers for? Yes?
In what sort of depth do we need to know the development of the central nervous system? Because I know we had a study on that, but it wasn't run by you,
So there are other lecturers who cover content, and you also had one on cardiogenesis as well, heart development. Look, it's a bit hard for me to say when somebody else has provided that content. Generally, when it comes to examining the material, it's the people who provide it that are requested to provide questions in those areas. So you've got me in sort of a catch-22 here, because I've not provided that material, I can't say what level of knowledge they'd expect you to have. In general, I hope that everyone follows the same rules that I follow, and that is, if I've given you the content in the lecture page, on that page, then that's the content I expect you to know. If I've given you that content in the lab classes, then that is the practical component that I expect you to know as well. If it's not part of something I'm going to examine you on or just helps your understanding, I'll often list it at the bottom of the content pages as additional information, so that helps you understand the content. Or if there are links that you click on that leave the actual lab pages, then that material is also to help you to understand, but not necessarily examinable. Because I know that all medical students are just concerned about what I'm going to be tested on. So hopefully that clarifies it for you. I've given you everything that you need to understand the content that you'd potentially be tested on in a practical or a theoretical manner in the content I provide to you. There's no tricks.
When the sperm fertilizes the ovum, what exactly is the cortical granule reaction? And also, what's membrane depolarization? I wasn't really sure about that.
Okay. So membrane depolarization, you probably cover in physiology, because it's a basic property of cells that talks about the charge across a membrane. And all I'm not a physiologist currently, so I'm just going to summarise what they tell you in a lecture course. And that membrane potential determines the properties of the cell. So the simplest way of thinking about it in neurobiology is an action potential that's used for transferring a signal along a neuron. Now, when I talked about the membrane potentials in the egg, what's actually happening there is that the shift in the membrane potential generates an initial block to polyfertilization, and that is it prevents further sperm fusing their membrane with the oocyte's membrane. So changing the membrane potential through a calcium wave that goes through the oocyte prevents that fusion event. So that's an initial block. This is followed up very rapidly by a release that's been triggered by these other changes of vesicles that lie directly underneath the plasma membrane of the oocyte. Now, these vesicles, if you like, are the equivalent or similar to the acrosome that we saw within the sperm cell, in that they contain enzymes, and these enzymes, when they're released, alter the zona pellucida glycoproteins to prevent sperm binding to them. So they're vesicles containing enzymes, just like the acrosome, and they're released following fertilisation, and they alter the properties of the zona pellucida protein. So basically, the spermatozoa is binding specifically to a zona pellucida protein, and following alteration of that glycoprotein, the sperm can no longer adhere to it. And therefore, this is the secondary block for polysperm. Yes? You want gastrulation? Is that what you're asking about? Okay. So, in gastrulation, the reason why I spend a lot of time in this third week of development talking about the processes that occur in the third week is because this establishes the three layers of the embryo that go on to form all of the tissues. And it's like first principles for an embryologist to begin at this point. So we can go on then from that point and talk about the fate of different layers of the embryo from that point. Up until that point, the embryo was an undifferentiated cellular mass. And the only difference that occurs prior to that is in the second week of development, it forms the bilaminar embryo. And I quickly skip through that differentiation, mainly because it just confuses all the students. So the hyperblast, epiblast issue. So in the third week, gastrulation. Here's the primitive disc viewed from the dorsal side. So this is the epiblast. This structure down the bottom here is the connecting stalk. And just above the connecting stalk and running to the centre of the embryonic disc, this represents a site which is visible on the surface of the epiblast as a black line. And that black line represents a valley. And the valley is the cells leaving that layer. So as the cells leave, it generates this region where they're actually migrating out of that epithelium. So that's why it's visible on the surface. These cells here are leaving this layer and going through this opening in here. It's an opening. At this, if we cut through it and looked at it end on, this is the process that's occurring. So here's our epiblast layer. And the epithelial cells in the epiblast layer are losing their connections with the adjacent cells and leaving this epithelium and migrating down to form the layers that lie underneath it. Now, the very first population of cells that leave the layer form a second epithelia directly underneath the first one, and that is the endoderm. And they form a continuous sheet of cells across the entire embryonic disc and lining the yolk sac underneath it. So this is a single layer of cells forming the cuboidal epithelium of the endoderm. When that's formed in the third week of development, an intact epithelium, that is the cells are adjacent, form adhesion junctions with each other, then the later of migrating cells coming through this primitive streak in this region here are not entering that epithelium. They remain in a middle layer and spread out between the two epithelia as disorganised cells. And this disorganised organisation of them, because it is an organisation, this disorganised organisation is the same as you'd find in adult connective tissue. And this, in the embryo, we described as a mesenchymal organisation, because it's not an epithelium. It's a connective tissue organisation, but we don't have mesoderminous as an adult, and so therefore we need to have another word for what connective tissue looks like in the embryo, and therefore we call it mesenchyme, an embryonic connective tissue. Now these cells here, and this is where a little bit of confusion arises, form the middle layer of the embryo, which is mesoderm. Mesoderm refers to the whole layer of this connective tissue cells, and the organisation of the cells is mesenchymal. Is that the description that you're after? So you're clear about that? Sorry, what's that? Which part of it do you want? The mesoderm part. So we've already formed in this embryo here, we've already got an epiblast layer. The first cells coming through form an intact endoderm layer underneath here. And the cells which continue to migrate through right through to week 4 in development. So gastrulation is not over and done within a day. It continues through the entire third week of development. Cells continue to leave the epiblast layer. These cells here, coming through after the endoderm's been formed, these cells do not integrate into the underlying endoderm but form this random organisation of cells which we describe as mesenchymal. And this mesenchymal organisation means that they're not a single layer but multi-layered and spread randomly apart relative to each other. Now the very next thing that happens to this middle mesodermal layer is conversion to an epithelium, because what happens is that the mesoderm adjacent to the midline here, these cells form an epithelial ball, which we know as a what? No, the notochord's in the midline. It will be here, but it will form an epithelial ball, a somite. So these cells still have the ability to transform into an epithelia, because the epithelia is just an organisation of the cells. And in the case of a somite, it's a transient epithelialisation, because we know that those somites break apart to form different tissues later on. The one in the midline directly underneath this, but running in the other end of the embryo, so the notochord itself is not found... The notochord itself is not found in this region here, but extends from the top of the primitive streak, this area which is known as the primitive node, is the end of the region of gastrulation. And from this node, a hollow channel extends in the opposite direction towards the cranial end, and that's where the notochord will form.
In the mesoderm.
Now, once again, when you read it in the embryology textbooks, you'll hear about a neuroenteric canal forming a notochordal plate which fuses with the endoderm and then rises again into the mesoderm to form an axial process that then differentiates into the notochord. I don't expect you to know any of that stuff. I just want you to be aware that you have a notochord that forms in that region.
So the cells that make the notochord, is it a separate
entity to the membrane, or is it just... They're described as axial mesoderms. That's the term that's used to describe them, so that you describe them as mesoderm instead of the middle layer.
So what's around it is still the mesoderm?
It's all mesoderm. Everything that's in the middle layer is the mesoderm. We then segment the mesoderm into axial or notochord, paraaxial somites, intermediate, lateral plate, which forms splanchnic and somatic.
With the somites, when they form, can you go to
different parts of them that can make different? Sure. So when a somite forms, it forms as a ball, and in the section that I showed you through an embryo, you can see that this is a section through the middle of one of these balls. So if I take a ball, chop it in half, this is what it looks like. It's got an epithelium around the outside of it, and it's got a core of the mesenchymal sort of random organisation of the cells. Now what happens is these cells proliferate, and this cavity within it called a somitocele is lost, and therefore it forms a solid ball of cells. Now, this ball of cells has different regions to it, which will go on to form different parts of the embryo. And so if we look at any single somite, the components of the somite that it forms is identical for every somite, but a different segment of the vertebral body. And that is how I've broken it up here. So if we take a single somite and its relative position to the notochord, which lies adjacent to it here, then I talked about two initial regions that form within the somite. The medial portion, and that is the piece closest to the midline, next to the notochord, which is described as sclerotome. The sclerotome, and I'm showing only one side, so there'd be another somite at the same segmental level on the other side, and it would have the same medial component that I'd also describe as a sclerotome. Now, this sclerotome and the one from the other side here engulf the notochord in this region and will form the vertebra and intervertebral disc. Now, there's a resegmentation of the vertebral column. There's a half somite shift when you form a vertebra and intervertebral element in a caudal direction. But I don't go through that with you. All you need to know is that it makes the vertebra and intervertebral disc. So I'm trying to clarify for you the depth at which I expect you to understand the concept, because it's more important you have an overview of when these things are occurring in sequence rather than the detailed understanding about the structures they'll form, which we'll talk about in system development. Or you may never have in medicine. You'll just have to read the stuff online. So this sclerotome has a fate that will form the vertebral column. There's a way of describing it. Now, the dorsal portion of it and the dorsal lateral portion, this little half moon of material out here away from the midline, is a region which we describe as the dermomyotome. And the name of it is exactly what it will go on to form, and that is it segments into a dorsal portion which forms the dermatome and a ventral portion which forms the myotome. The dermatome forms the dermis. The myotome forms the muscle, skeletal muscle. And then we talk about the final changes that are occurring within the somite. And remember, the somite is a transient structure, so its actual overall structure as a ball is lost as part of its ongoing development. So in later development, we don't see somites. what you see is the appearance of where the vertebral elements are forming, where the sclerotome is forming. So what happens to the components? Well, the sclerotome on either side will engulf the notochord and form the vertebral body. The notochord itself degenerates in the adult. It remains as a remnant. It forms the nucleus pulposus of the intervertebral disc. So that structure, the gelatinous core of the intervertebral disc, is derived from the notochord. That's the only structure that it makes. The dermatome here, even though it's in a small segment, it spreads out underneath the epithelium of the embryo and forms the underlying connective tissue of the skin. So the skin has two different embryonic origins. The epithelium is what?
Ectoderm.
And therefore the dermis, I've just told you, is mesoderm. So it's got a mesoderm and an ectoderm origin. And we can go on even further. We can talk about the melanocytes in the skin, which are neural crest. So we can break down the different organs and tissues of the body to its different embryonic origins based upon its lamina origin. So this spreads out throughout the skin. And interestingly enough, it maintains its relationship to the original somite. So the dermatomal pattern of innovation, of sensory innovation of the skin, reflects the original dermatomal organisation from the somites. So the segmental nerve that comes out of the vertebral element, formed by that somite, will innervate the dermis in relation to it. When you do your clinical tests that you always do of checking for the intactness of a peripheral sensory nerve, looking for sensation in different regions of the skin and whether that nerve has been damaged, the pattern of sensory innervation loss from a region of the skin that delimits that dermatome or segmental nerve has been established by the original segmentation in the embryo. And that's also why, let me get back to the last thing, the reason why the dermatome on the skin has such an interesting pattern, because it reflects, it's established before rotation of the limbs occur. And therefore, when the limbs rotate in week 8, they rotate the dermatomes on the limbs and give you the specific pattern of segmental innervation you see in the limbs. You'll see it later. So there's the dermatome. The myotome forms the skeletal... Just one second, let me finish this summary. The myotome forms all of the skeletal muscles of the body. And it can be broken down as we have broken down everything into two components. We describe it as the apaxial and hypaxial muscles. And anatomically, the apaxial muscles are all of the column muscles that are found on the dorsal side of the embryo, around the back of the vertebral column, and the rectus spinae and things like that that are used for moving the vertebral column. The hypaxial muscle groups are the three layers of muscles found around the abdominal wall, it's been a long time since I've done gross, the two angled ones and the horizontal ones. And as well as that, the somites at the level of the limb buds from the hypaxial region will go into the limb bud and form the flexors and extensors of the upper and lower limb buds. So they're all of the structures that the somites will contribute, and each somite breaks down in the same manner. So you don't have to learn thousands of different somite organisations. Your question?
So you know how you were talking about the dermatome moving from the dermis, and then later on clinically, the sensory innervation that attaches the skin. How is it that, like, when the dermatome
is moving out, the ectoderm,
like, allows the formation of sensory nerves?
Yeah, so sensory nerves will be peripheral nervous system, won't they?
Yeah.
So peripheral nervous system will be neural crest, and neural crest cells that lie outside the central nervous system will be innervating sensory structures that lie in those regions. So neural crest cells will also be following into those patches in a segmental pattern. I'm not going to do peripheral nervous system with you, but all of the movements and growth of the nerves are occurring following, just after the dermis has been migrated.
So it's not the ectoderm that forms the sensory sensory.
Well, it will be ectoderm because neural crest is ectoderm in origin.
Oh.
So usually when you're talking about ectoderm and nervous system, you're talking about neural tube.
whereas neural tube will be the motor organisation, and the segmental motor organisation fits into the somatic organisation as well. So the different muscles from different levels formed from those somites will be innervated by nerves coming from those nerves as well.
Okay. I remind you that I just answer the questions you ask. It doesn't necessarily mean that I consider them to be the most relevant to your understanding of the content for the theory exams or practical exams. I just answer what you ask. Yes. I missed the first bit, sorry. Oh, okay, so they would normally be kept open by the trophoblasts around their ends, and normally a blood vessel's normal response to being opened is the smooth muscle in the wall to spontaneously contract. And basically that's what happens within the spiral arteries. The smooth muscles, when they're no longer maintained open because all of that material is shed along with the placenta, the remnants, which are just the open spiral arteries, now can contract in that local region, and that will be the initial shutdown of the spiral artery, and of course blood coagulation will occur in the end as well.
So, is there anything to do with the...
Look, there may be a whole range of things that, which contribute to the contraction of the smooth muscle. In addition to that, you're also getting the uterus decreasing in volume, so you're actually squeezing those blood vessels down. So there's probably a whole range of factors which are shutting down the spiral arteries, but clearly there are abnormalities which can occur where they're not closed off and shut down, and the mother can bleed out through those under certain conditions. But I'd say in general it's because you remove the opening structures which maintain the arteries open. They're the initial things and allow the smooth muscle to do what it would normally do, which would be to contract, close it off. The uterus is contracting as well, which is shutting down the spiral arteries, and there may also be a hormonal influence as well. Yes?
On your website, would you happen to have a video which shows all the folding in the...
Around the ventral side? You mean the trilaminar embryo folding ventrally?
Folding and then the...
Look, I should make one, shouldn't I? It's probably the easiest way to go. All of the movies that I have available are on, if you click the thing that says Flash Movies, and unless you can see one there that looks terribly exciting, I guess this is probably the closest one here, but this is actually after that you've already folded it up initially, and this is showing you how the neural tube has been closed in the fourth week, and it's folding over the yolk sac. It's not as early as you want, which is when the trilaminar embryo folds. I'll make an effort to put one together. But there are additional animations there that are supposed to help you understand dynamic processes. The other one, which probably is closest, is this one here, where you do actually have the trilaminar embryo shown in a rostral caudal plane, so cut down the mid-sagittal section. And this is actually showing how the cranial end folds over ventrally. Here's the heart. And folds over ventrally, and so does the tail, bringing the connecting stalk ventrally and the heart ventrally as well. But it's not the whole disc. That's about as close as I can come. Yes, sorry.
In all the pictures that we have, all the scanning electron micrograph pictures, is that where the embryo has been removed from the amniotic sac?
Yes. You wouldn't be able to see the embryo if it was still inside its sac, you'd see a bubble of amnion. And a scan EM of a bubble of amnion is not that informative. The only time that you can actually see it with the amnion intact is in the serial sections of the early embryo, the stage 13 embryo. We actually section the whole amniotic sac surrounding the embryo. So in those cross sections in stage 13, they're showing you the amniotic membrane surrounding the whole embryo. But in the rest of them, in order to be able to see the embryo, we tear away the sac, and in addition to that, on those scan EMs, often portions of the embryo have been removed as well. So in order to see the heart tube, you can't see it unless you move part of the anterior body wall. When you remove that, you're actually looking into the pericardial cavity and seeing the heart tube lying within the cavity. So that's the only way in a scan EM you can see those.
So if you go to the I think it's the bilaminate embryo, one of the micrograph pictures. It's sort of, it's always confusing when we look at it, because you just get one and it's just like, you don't really know what it is.
Oh, is it the scanning again or a diagram? Oh, so the three-layered one?
It could be three-layer. It didn't, I think, with three.
Oh, wrong place, isn't it? But at least my window. So this picture here... You're looking at exactly the same view you're looking at in the picture below it. So this is a bright field picture of the embryo, and I've rotated the picture that I originally had around so it's in the same orientation. So this is the embryonic disc viewed from the dorsal side, and this... Sorry? The whole, where you see this edge ripped away here, that's where it's been cut away. So this is the amniotic sac removed from the dorsal side. Now, if you didn't remove that, all you'd be looking down on would be the exterior surface of the amniotic sac. So in order to see these structures, you actually have to cut away parts of them. And in this case, the amnion's been cut away in this region. So you can see the primitive groove, the primitive node in this region. And this is the whole embryonic disc with a connecting stalk down here. So it's the same sort of view. I've tried to put them next to each other there. Now remember, these videos, in many cases the cartoon ones, are based upon textbook images and are basically a simplified interpretation. They can't be everything to everyone, and so they're often showing a specific concept, not everything about embryonic development.
The last video, week 3, is that happening within the endometrium or is it bulging out?
Yeah, so this section here shows you the trilaminar embryo and the three cavities of the conceptus. The yolk sac on the ventral side, the amniotic sac on the dorsal side, and this big white cavity around here is what? Chorionic cavity. Now that whole stuff is embedded within the uterine wall.
So would the uterine wall be on...
The blood side of the uterine wall would be on this side where the connecting stalk is. The lumen would be over here, but the epithelium of the uterus would be overlying this as well. So we're actually just looking at the region of where the embryonic disc is formed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the lumen.
Yeah. Yes. I can't hear you, sorry. Of the chorionic cavity. Okay. So this one here is the chorionic cavity formation. And look, it has to be simplified in order to try and make it a cartoon. Let's go with that. In the second week of development, we have a bilaminar embryo, an epiblast and a hyperblast, amniotic cavity, and this structure here would have been the primitive yolk sac lined with hyperblast. Now, during the third week in development, mesoderm spreads around the wall of the primitive yolk sac. So this is the mesoderm spreading around, and it forms a layer around the entire cavity, including this region here over the amnion. Now all of this is extra embryonic mesoderm, and what happens is the same sort of vacuolization that we see that occurs in the lateral plate mesoderm, and that is that we've got a thick layer of extra embryonic mesoderm, and a cavity forms within it and allows the yolk sac to collapse down in week 3 to form this smaller yolk sac which has mesoderm over its surface. And this cavity out here that is lined now entirely by mesoderm, this is the site of the chorionic cavity formation. Now this whole structure's embedded in the uterine wall, and here's the uterus epithelium over the surface. These are the maternal blood-filled spaces, and this is a uterine gland over here. So in this way, we have a bilaminar embryo, and we've formed the three extra embryonic cavities, or coelomes, the amnion, the yolk sac, and the chorion. Yes, so there is still contention about the origin of extra embryonic mesoderm. There are some textbooks which describe as being partially derived from the trophoblast layer, the side trophoblast layer, and it may be a contribution. And other groups believe that it's part of the gastrulation process, so that we actually see mesoderm formed from gastrulation leaving the embryonic disc. I don't care at this stage. I want you to know that it's extraembryonic mesoderm and that it lies outside of the embryo. If there are contentious issues, I don't see the point of trying to put one where you're going to see multiple opinions.
The epiglottis forms the ectoderm, endoderm, and things like that, right? What happens to the hypoglottis?
It doesn't form anything. Let's think of it as a wonderful time we had last summer in the second week of development, and they're only fond memories. That's all we've got. Yes? I'm going to... So the question was, what's the yolk sac and what function does it form? The yolk sac is partially you will be covering a lot of this in BGDB. If you look at the notes that refer to gut development, they may help you understand it. But at this stage, let's just think about it in general terms. This yolk sac here on the ventral side, when the embryonic disc folds, and remember it'll fold from this side here ventrally and this side here ventrally, it'll grab a part of this yolk sac and form the gut out of it. Okay? So that's what part of the yolk sac is going to be doing. The other bit of the yolk sac that remains is a bubble out here that doesn't get grabbed by the disc when it folds. This forms the yolk sac that lies outside of the embryo, but is still connected to the embryo at the midgut level. Now, an important role for this extra-embryonic structure, the yolk sac, is in birds and reptiles, it actually is the source of nutrition. So the blood vessels that form in its wall surround the yolk sac, and it's used for growth of the embryo within the egg shell. It's got no other source of nutrition. But in us, it's used for another component, and that is blood vessels form throughout all of the mesoderm. And in the mesoderm around the yolk sac, these blood vessels form a vascular network running to and from the embryo. So it forms a vitelline vasculature, and the vitelline arteries are running towards the heart, so back from the yolk sac. Vitelline veins are going out to the yolk sac, and these vitelline vasculature will contribute to the portal circulation of the gut. So the blood vessels that form in the mesoderm of the yolk sac do have a contribution to portal circulation within the gut. The second major role that the yolk sac has, that when the blood vessels form in the mesoderm, they form as little islands of blood vessel structures, and the outside will form the blood vessel wall itself, but the cells in the core form the red blood cells of circulation, or they're the hematopoietic stem cells. So the vast majority of early blood is derived from these blood islands on the surface of the yolk sac. That's what its role is. Yes? The green in this stage is the trophoblasts. These are the cytotrophoblasts around here, the cellular layer, and the pale green region with the spread nuclei are the syncytia trophoblasts. The maternal materials are the blood-filled spaces, which will be maternal blood, where spiral arteries have been opened, and the uterine gland here, which also is opened up and is a source of nutrition. All this white material will be the stroma of the uterine cavity, the underlying connective tissue. It's all of this material which, from the practical class which you've just had, or will have if you're doing it on Wednesday, is decidualised. So the decidual cells are all of these stromal cells out here that are converted by the hormones. Okay, so I spent a lot of time talking about the early stages in development. I want to remind you that by the end of this BGDA, we've covered all of development. And the reason I spend a lot of time in practical, those two practicals in embryonic development, is because the first trimester and those first 8 weeks is when all of the major organs begin to form. So it's the organogenic period, so that's why I focus a lot on that time as well. For fetal development, I'm going to cover a lot of the fetal issues in the practical class. And within fetal development, there are some systems which are still continuing to develop during the fetal period, whereas there are other systems which were formed in the embryonic period and are continuing to grow through the fetal period. So things like the heart has its four-chambered structure by the end of the embryonic period, but obviously if I had an embryonic heart, it would be this big. So it physically is growing in volume, but its structure has been established during the embryonic period. Whereas there are other systems like the respiratory tract, whereby it hasn't completed all of its branching and differentiation, and this occurs during the fetal period. And the same thing for the gonads and the endocrine system and the renal system. All of those systems have a fetal component to their development. Does that make sense to you? So there are some systems which have a long period of development, which continues into fetal development, whereas some of them were established in the organogenic period and are just growing. So the other examples would be, for example, the skin. We've formed the epithelium, we've formed the dermis, but we may not have formed all of the hair follicles or the sensory structures by the end of the embryonic period. They may be primitive structures. The other features that I'll point out to you, and it cropped up in one of the SGS groups and a physiologist got back to me. In the first practical class, let me go back to the first practical class here. First practical class, when I was covering fertilisation to implantation, I covered the initial stage of this development by talking about oogenesis and ovulation, talking about the generation of oocytes and the hormonal changes associated with the menstrual cycle. And look, the figure that I used here for the menstrual cycle, let me go back, was a very simplified curve. And some people had a lecture on the endocrinology of the menstrual cycle, and they compared the curve that I showed you with the curve that was given in the lecture, and they looked different. It was never meant to be the actual hormonal levels. It was always meant to be just a simplified representation of hormonal changes. Because it was an issue for some students, I went back and actually put real data into the curve. So this is now the absolute changes in hormonal levels during the cycle, and represents data collected in this case in endocrinology and in this case from a research article. The major difference between this curve that I show you now is that it more accurately represents the surge in estrogen changes through the cycle, and also demonstrates that the change in body temperature occurs slightly longer delay period after ovulation. So the original cartoon showed you, it's still available somewhere, the original cartoon basically said at ovulation, if I can open it, that the temperature spiked immediately. Well, this is a longer curve here, and similarly for the estrogen changes, the peaks are more clearly represented in the second newer curve. Now, it was never meant to be the exact curves, but now it is. There you go. What were the other issues that I wanted to cover? We still haven't done the last practical together, and I haven't done endocrine organ development with you. There is no, I think the histologists give you the, do you get a histology of the endocrine system? Anyone get a nod? Yeah? Okay, so I'll be giving you this week a lecture on, I think it's you or BGUB, one of you, is getting a lecture on endocrine gland development as well. It might be BGUB, maybe I'm getting it mixed up. Actually, yeah, no, now that I look at it, it's not you. Let me take that back. I can see it here. It's a lecture to BGUB, so I'll give it to you next cycle. So you should, from the at the end of BGDA with me in embryology, you'll have gone from what I gave you in foundations as human development and the trimester organisation and the events going on, to a more detailed understanding of the events that are occurring in the embryonic period of the first trimester, and the events that are going on in the second and third trimester, and in the fetal development class, I take you right through to the neonate. So we'll be talking about changes that are occurring neonatally as well. So the next practical we do will cover the second and third trimester through to neonatal development. Importantly, I want you to also remember importantly, I also want you to remember that what I'm trying to do is to put it in context for you in a clinical setting, and that is the critical periods of development graph that I keep on pushing at you refers to times in which systems can be affected by external influences, and I call them environmental influences, but in textbooks they'll often be described as maternally derived abnormalities. I never use that term because I think it puts too much emphasis on the mother being responsible for the abnormality in development, whereas it's the environment in which development's occurring that's responsible for it. So you need to be aware of critical periods of development when systems can be affected for major abnormalities. Since we've only got a minute or so left, if there are any additional questions that you have, I always accept email questions to me. I generally prefer to give an answer where everyone can see what my response is. So if I get a large number of questions about the content that you've had, I'll make a web page on the site which will be called BGDA questions or something like that and answer it there. I think it's a better value that everyone gets the same answer rather than you as an individual getting your response tailored to you. Thanks very much for your attention, guys.